Teach your children well. Their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams. The one they fix, the one you know by.
Friends who listen to futureprimitive.org, as promised, I am back again here with Rick Doblin, who is the president of MAPS, and you heard some about his bio last time we talked, so I feel we're just going to jump into the second part of our conversation. And the second part of our conversation is going to be about MAPS Bulletin, Volume 6, Number 1, which is a really beautiful edition of their magazine, which is called Psychedelics and Ecology. And I am going to read the names of the contributors to this magazine. First of all, I want to say that the editor is David J. Brown. And then the first contributor is Kathleen Harrison. Also, Stanley Krippner and David Luke, Ralph Metzner, Gregory Sams, Valerie Leveroni Corral, Dragonfly de la Luz, Rick Harlow, Jeremy Narby, interviewed by David J. Brown, Dennis McKenna, also interviewed, and Daniel Siebert, as well as Mark A. Schroll and Donald Rothenberg, David Lawler, Dale Pendel, John Allen, Mark Von Tilo, and Sheena Turlington, Sam Mickey, Kim Dawson, Daniel Pinchbeck, Michael and Violet Devine, Louise Reitman, Sarah Huntley, Lily Ross, and I wanted to acknowledge greatly the man who did the painting for the cover. Can you say his name, Rick?
Yes, his name is Rick Harlow.
Okay.
People could learn more about him at a website that he has. I don't actually have the URL for that, but it would be under Rick Harlow.
Okay.
And he's been very much influenced by his ayahuasca experiences, and he's painted from the visions that he's had while he's been under the influence of ayahuasca.
Yes, and that cover to me is extremely beautiful. And of course, there are other paintings and illustrations in the bulletin. And I wanted to say that you can go to the MAPS website and you can bring up the latest bulletin and you can read it online. And otherwise, like I'm going to do, it'll be possible to order it online from MAPS. Now, I just wanted to open this, Rick, by saying that, you know, to me, one of the most wonderful things I heard from Albert Hofmann is that the border between France and Switzerland is an acorn. And for me, who lived between France and Switzerland and lived through border crossings for my whole childhood, that delights me so deeply, and it denominates the link between ecology and psychedelics. And then I want to say that you said in your editorial, the first article in the MAPS bulletin, you said that psychedelics and ecology, the link between psychedelics and ecology, is direct and fundamental, and that they are connecting threads. Would you speak to that?
Yes, I would. Thank you, Jenna. First, I'll say this is actually, it looks like 6, but it's volume 19.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's in small print. It looks like six.
Okay.
But, you know, Mass, I started in 1986, and we started the bulletin a few years later. So what we've done is a series of special issues. Not just most of our issues are about the progress of our studies or the lack of progress with our studies and the political obstacles. But this particular issue is a special issue about psychedelics and ecology. We've also done special issues about rites of passage, kids and psychedelics, psychedelics and self-discovery, technology and psychedelics, sex, spirit, and psychedelics. And these are ways that we try to discuss kind of the influence of psychedelics on a particular area,
mm-hmm.
so that they're more, I think, of interest to the general public. They're less time sensitive because they're more about ideas and topics.
Mm-hmm.
And the one about psychedelics and ecology, which we've just done, it's particularly important because this sense of the psychedelic mystical experience, which is both for thousands of years, psychedelics have been connected to religious use, spiritual use, and also more recently, psychedelics have been studied in clinical research settings, looking for the link between psychedelics and mystical experience and spirituality.
Mm-hmm.
And the essence of the mystical experience generated by psychedelics or meditation or any number of different ways, prayer.
Right.
And that the essence of the mystical experience is a sense of unity.
Okay.
It transcends time and space, that connects everything in one large web of life. The sense of connection is something that is also at the core of the understandings or growing understanding about ecology.
Mm-hmm.
And whereas not too long ago, this whole idea that we could trash certain areas of the planet, that we could have enormous garbage dumps, that we could be not very wise about conserving resources, that it was okay because in people's minds because, you know, you can throw something out. There's like an out somewhere. There's an in and an out. There's somewhere that's separate.
Yes.
That somehow or other, you know, we could sacrifice certain areas, or that, you know, in economics they call it the externalities, the sort of social costs of a particular production that's not accounted for in the price. It's sort of just absorbed by the environment. And so the mystical experience, which many of us have come to through psychedelics, is this sense that there is no out, there is no away, there is no
right.
And a utopia that, you know, that you could run to, that we're all bound up in this one single web of life.
Exactly.
And we see that more and more people are coming to understand that with the picture of the Earth from the moon, with the understandings about global warming that affects beyond borders of countries, that this sense that we are both connected and that we belong, and the implications of that for our understanding of ecology produce a greater sense of respect for nature, a greater willingness to make certain sacrifices for recycling or for lowering our carbon footprint or our energy use or looking for efficiencies and energy, questioning why we're constantly buying things.
Mm-hmm.
But what we're hoping is that this massive explosion of population, of depletion of the world's resources, of extinction of species,
mm-hmm.
that with more and more people able to have direct experience of this sense of unity, this sense of connection, that will change people's behaviors and attitudes. When people are having to focus very much on day-to-day survival, these longer-term issues are ones that people feel that they don't have the luxury to pay attention to.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
even when people are no longer struggling for survival on a daily basis, if they haven't grown up with a certain respect for our interconnectedness,
mm-hmm.
they can still repeat these kind of behaviors that in the aggregate are extremely destructive of the environment, of social systems, of you know, our whole planet is imperiled in a lot of different ways.
Mm-hmm.
And so for us, this, I mean, MAPS focuses primarily on developing therapeutic uses of psychedelics for treating specific clinical indications like post-traumatic stress disorder or anxiety associated with end of life or
right.
excessive compulsive disorder. But this broader and in some ways more important area of psychedelics and personal growth, personal exploration, you know, this direct connection with spirituality, that's in a way what Tim Leary would speak about in terms of individual freedom, and that we don't need mediators or priests or popes or
right.
rabbis or, you know, to connect us to the spiritual connection, the spiritual sense of things, and that we have to really find it in ourselves. And with psychedelics, once we find this connection and experience it, not just understand it, but experience it, particularly at very deep emotional levels,
okay.
when people come out, they are much more willing to understand and negotiate the responsibilities that come from recognizing that we're part of this larger web of life. And so that's really what this whole special issue of the bullpen is about, is different people who have had different kind of inspirational experiences with psychedelics
mm-hmm.
reflecting on what that has done in terms of their understanding of nature, ecology, and how we can try to move to a sustainable culture that mitigates this, you know, incredible impact that the, you know, billions and billions of people that live on the Earth that have the Earth has never carried so many people.
That's right.
Population increase is still rising at an exponential level.
Mm-hmm.
And whether we can be smart enough to sort of survive, to produce enough material, goods, food, and do it in a way that's respectful of the other species and of nature, that's still an open question. We look at the destruction of the Amazon. We look at all sorts of problems in terms of the loss of topsoil. I mean, you can go on and on and on.
Yeah.
The pesticides that are everywhere and all sorts of toxic chemicals that are just in mother's milk and wherever we look in the water. You know, it's a situation that time is now limited. I mean, time is infinite, but at the same time, time, in order to avoid some of these dire outcomes, is relatively limited in the span of, you know, a couple generations, let's say. I mean, I don't want to make it like it all has to happen in the next year or two, or, you know, or even in the next decade, but, you know, in the next several generations, the load, the humanity's load on the planet and the changes that we're able to impose on other species, on plants and animals and on the care and capacity of the Earth is dramatic. So that over the course of several generations, it's like an ocean liner. We need to start changing the course of
yes.
this ocean liner.
Yes.
And what we're trying to draw attention to is that this mystical experience aided by psychedelics is something that is in the reach of most people, particularly if we can remove the sort of war on drugs mentality, which
right.
has criminalized
right.
these experiences, which, of course, millions of people have made different decisions for themselves about
mm-hmm.
whether these are laws that deserve to be respected or not.
Mm-hmm.
And many people have sort of been able to draw inspiration, not just to appreciate, more importantly, our position in the sort of the Gaia that we all enjoy, but also it's moved people to social justice and social action.
Right.
That's also what's part of the bulletin that we wanted to highlight, is that not only do people understand at a deeper emotional level how we're all interwoven into one collective
organism,
life force, but that people are motivated to use our own limited lifespans in order to make some sort of contribution to improving things for everybody. So, you know, one of the articles that's in the bulletin is about the Biosphere project.
Right, right.
You know, and how some of the people that were involved in the Biosphere project, did have these more mystical understandings, and indeed some of them had influences in their earlier lives with psychedelics.
Well, John Allen speaks about his relationship with the Wichol people and his experiences with peyote.
Yeah, and how that helped inspire him for Biosphere 2. And, it's the miniature Earth that was built under glass, the world's largest laboratory
right.
for global ecology. One thing that's very sad in a way for me, but also hopeful, is that there are so many people, millions and millions of people, that have had beneficial experiences with psychedelics that have gone on to make important contributions in their own lives and some contributions that affected many other people's lives based on their psychedelic experiences, but they've been uncomfortable about sharing their psychedelic experiences
absolutely.
In the current political climate.
Yes, absolutely.
And so this bulletin is another purpose of these special issues, is to get people from a range of backgrounds who can together sort of come out, like the mm-hmm. gay movement in a
mm-hmm.
way, where people can come out and say, part of my inspiration has been through these substances. They've been used for thousands of years. I mean, not LSD, for example, that was invented in 1938 and, the psychedelic properties discovered in 1943.
Right.
But it's very much like morning glory seeds. The chemical is very similar, but it also has into antiquity, a use in religious context.
Yes, the kikion. Yeah. Well, let me go straight to what concerns me here. In my first psychedelic experience with LSD, I was completely detached from nature. I grew up in Paris. I had no idea of what nature was apart from the manicured gardens of Versailles. Right? So, in my first experience, I had an encounter with a mighty tree.
Wow.
And that was extremely profound for me. And the tree was my teacher. So the meat of my question is this. Once again, if this is true, if there can be a deep connection when, like Catherine Harrison, for instance, talks about taking a medicine walk. She talks about the awe that she has in nature when she takes a compound or a substance. How can people safely take these things and make this connection with nature in a climate like this? How can this set and setting be created? I mean, I know nothing more beautiful than taking mushrooms and going out in nature.
Well, that's an essential question that you're asking. And before I'll talk about how, I would just like to underscore that the experience that you describe with the tree,
mm-hmm.
which has stayed with you all
mm-hmm.
these years,
mm-hmm.
something about psychedelic experiences are so vivid and are imprinted so deeply that the idea that an experience can have lifelong consequences, you've just demonstrated. You've brought it alive to us about this experience with this tree
mm-hmm.
that has stayed with you. And so for people to have these kind of direct experiences with nature, with spirituality,
mm-hmm.
that should be a fundamental basic human right.
That's right.
And the drug war, which tries to impose a system of prohibition in order to prevent a small minority of people from having difficult or bad experiences
mm-hmm.
from drug abuse,
mm-hmm.
that this cost that's imposed on, let's say, the 90% of the people that would do this well to supposedly protect the 10% that has problems.
Right.
When the 10% that have problems could use drug treatment, they could use more compassionate resources than the threat of prison.
Yeah.
So that we have something that we're talking about is paradoxical, because we're saying that in order to right the out-of-balance planet,
yes,
there are certain experiences that are themselves criminalized.
Yes, so, nature is criminalized.
Yeah, plants that just grow in nature, you can't take them for certain reasons. So we have this divided attitude socially, and there's a need, and there's also this criminal prohibition that's blocking that need. And yet, if you look at the articles in this issue of the Bulletin, people that have approached in a respectful way these experiences, even though they've been on the other side of the law, mm-hmm. have felt that they have made them, given themselves experiences that have brought them more into balance
mm-hmm.
with understanding nature. So I just wanted to underscore the human right abuses of our current system. So in order to provide a safe context, we have to recognize that there is, unfortunately still, but less and less so, this marginalization, suppression, and criminalization of these kind of experiences.
Yes.
So safety is not just in terms of personal psychological safety, but it's also in terms of safety with the social context. And I would say, though, that if we can sort of put aside for a moment this idea that, you know, these drugs are illegal for any use for which you've not gotten permission. There are some cultures in the United States, like the Native American Church, that can legally use peyote. There's some small groups, less than 1,000 people, with the Uñada Vegetal,
exactly,
that can legally use ayahuasca.
Right.
But for most people, it's on the other side of law. So that if we can sort of say, though, that the enforcement, because, in a way, of our economic crisis, there's a prioritization taking place. And there's also been a lot of time since the cultural turmoil of the psychedelic 60s, and so mm-hmm. the zeal
mm-hmm.
For punishment and the symbolic politics of being anti-drug is diminishing somewhat.
Mm-hmm.
So it's easier to be safe from a social point of view than it's been, but you have to be careful who you talk to, you have to be careful where you procure these substances. If you can pick mushrooms by yourself, you know, you don't have those problems about where to get them. But I'd say that, let's put that aside. The next issue is more just psychological safety.
Right.
And,
exactly.
You know, now, I'll say in our highly controlled therapeutic studies, they all take place indoors. And it was my understanding, I mean, we're monitoring people's temperature and blood pressure. We're okay. videotaping and audio taping. It's important that we do it indoors. But we have this situation where if people reach a certain emotional state, it is acceptable to take them outdoors. And I'll describe a situation in our Israeli study for MDMA, for post-traumatic stress disorder. There was about 6 months ago, there was a man who had post-traumatic stress disorder from the Six-Day War in 1967.
Sure.
This is over 40 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And he's still burdened by post-traumatic stress disorder from that experience.
Uh-huh.
And during his MDMA experience, he had got agitated. He sort of lost track of where he was. Was he back in the past? Was he in this hospital room? And he felt like he really needed to get grounded. Now, fortunately, this study is taking place at Bir Yaakov Mental Health Center. It's the largest mental hospital in Israel. And there's a fair amount of grounds and nature around the different buildings.
Okay.
And so the therapist had the wisdom to say, all right, let's go for a walk. You know, physically you're fine. There's no problems with your blood pressure. We can disconnect you from,
okay,
you know, this kind of monitoring systems, and we'll just take a walk with you.
Mm-hmm.
And so they ended up taking a walk, and they sort of said, here's a tree, this is a bush, you're safe, this is in nature.
Mm-hmm.
And for him, this being outdoors was incredibly grounding.
Mm-hmm.
Now, actually it was a little bit more than 6 months ago, because something very ironic happened.
Yes.
Which was that while He was outdoors, getting grounded and working through, doing the really emotional work of sort of working through the trauma of bringing up the fear of what his wartime experiences had been in 1967.
Right.
At that exact time.
Yes.
Overhead were planes that were flying to bomb Gaza.
Wow.
So that we had one individual that was healing from post-traumatic stress disorder from war by being in part in nature,
mm-hmm.
and at the same time there was a war raging that was producing tens of thousands of more cases of post-traumatic stress disorder.
Wow, what a paradox.
So, you know, in a way it seems like, what is the point of our work? It's so small in the context of the destruction and hatred that's taking place in the world. It's so few people that we're treating. But at the same time, we're trying to point to something that that other people can do that eventually, hopefully, will integrate this into society. So there's a way in which this sort of calming aspect of nature
mm-hmm.
really helped this man. And, you know, I'm now reminded there was one time that I took MDMA by myself. I was camping out in Big Sur, California. It's the most beautiful spot. I was down by the
right.
ocean.
Yeah.
The mountains came down within about, you know, 6 feet or so of the high tide mark.
Oh, it's exquisite.
Yeah, and I had built myself a little place there to camp out. You know, when the tide went out, I was able to get small stones, and I built up this little bed area, and I did it at night. So one of the things is that you want to be, if you are doing this in nature, you want to feel like you're safe. And, you know, it would be a good idea for most people to have somebody there that's with them, or at least to be familiar enough with the substances so they're comfortable on their own.
Mm-hmm.
And I had this, I did it at night, and at one point, just the immensity of the roaring ocean in front of me, the mountain coming right behind me, and then the stars in the sky were just so vast that I felt like I would just lose myself into the universe.
Yes.
And there was this sense that there's a safety that comes from letting yourself go. You know, this holding back at different points, that's the part that, in a way, can get you in trouble
mm-hmm.
with these powerful psychedelic experiences. It helps if you sort of open and go with it. And so I felt like I was going to be, you know, flung out into the universe and lose track of who I was.
Right.
And that sort of happened a little bit, but then I had this recognition that I was still there, that somehow or other, the way the universe was structured, that there was gravity.
Wow.
And gravity was holding me down, was sort of keeping my molecules together, that because of this force of gravity that felt to me loving and
mm-hmm.
necessary for life, that I felt that I was cradled in the arms of gravity.
Beautiful.
It felt like as warm and rich emotionally as if I had been with a lover. And
yes.
I was thinking about, actually, some Brother David Steinlerost, who's a Roman Catholic monk who
yes.
lived in a monastery not too far from where I was camping out. And I was trying to imagine what a monastic life would be like.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what are the advantages and what are the disadvantages? And I finally felt like during this experience, when I broke through to sort of the loving arms of gravity
mm-hmm.
and felt that as not just a concept, but as something really live, that was, to me, I think, what people look for in a monastic life, that you find the universal and it feels as warm and rich as an individual.
Beautiful correlation, yes.
Yeah, so there's the safety, though, was that I was in a place where nobody was going to come. I could be in a non-rational state, so I didn't have to worry that if somebody came up, I'd have to learn how to talk again. You know, that
that's right, that's right. Yes, of course.
You know, so the other, so that's a key part, is that you feel like you can explore these sometimes nonverbal states of mind where you forget who you are, you forget how to talk, you're just more pure experience, that you don't have to too quickly move out of that.
Mm-hmm.
I also had it so that the very next day, all I needed to do was rest. There wasn't anything else that I had to
Beautiful.
Pull myself back together again.
Yep.
Basically, it's like this expansion of the ego into more universal, and then it, you know, it presents challenges if you have to sort of become back to yourself, and in particular. The other part is that, and this I think is sort of crucial, is this idea that when we take these psychedelic drugs,
yes.
there's an emergence into consciousness of previously unconscious material, and that it can be of related to connection with nature. It can be
yes.
spiritual, but it could also be therapeutic in a sense. It could also be about particular incidents from your biography.
Material from, yeah.
That is really important. So I think that our approach in therapy is that we have all these goals, you know, particularly if we're working with somebody with post-traumatic stress disorder, and you talk about these goals. But once you start the session, it's really not helpful to keep a rigid in mindset about, I want to experience connection with nature.
Okay.
Or, you know, you sort of turn over, you relinquish control from your conscious intention to your unconscious mind.
Exactly.
And it may take you to this, to connection with nature. It may take you to spirituality. It may take you elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Your biography. It may take you into what Stan Grof has talked about as this sort of death rebirth process.
Yes, yes.
Where you're terrified this ego is being, like I described, I was scared that I would fly out into space.
Right.
With the immensity. That there's fears. And it's important to, like meditation, to be with whatever is coming up. So I think it's a little bit of a problem to plan, like, I'm going to go out in nature, I'm going to take this drug, and I'm going to feel like I'm bound to, you know, experience a deep sense of, you know, our ecological interwoven nature and connection with everything. That's good to have that as a goal, and you set it up by picking a beautiful spot, making sure you're safe, making sure you're physically not in danger. You know, people shouldn't have to have responsibility, ideally, for their physical safety, because you're going into these more inner worlds and you're not paying attention so much to physical safety.
Right.
And yet, you know, you really want to let it manifest however it's going to. So if it turns out that you end up working on, you know, psychological issues from your biography, well then, that itself may be then the doorway to spirituality, or the doorway to a deeper appreciation of nature, even if you do it outside. Even if you do it outside in a beautiful nature spot, you carry with you all of the experiences that have happened before, and you may be in a beautiful spot having a horrible, terrible experience working through painful parts of your life.
Mm-hmm.
But the more that you can open to them, they kind of flow through you, and chances are some point there will be, during that will be some sort of, you know, connection with nature, if that's where you've set it up. But the importance of letting your intentions go and opening to what comes, float down the river and see what happens.
Surrender. Yeah.
So I think that's part. This idea that people should have the next day or so with no obligations and no responsibilities, most people overlook that part. And I think that that's the integration. Because, again, we're not just looking for certain kinds of experiences. We're also looking for how those experiences can be integrated into our daily lives and inform our daily lives and our daily decisions that we make moment to moment to moment.
Very well said. Yep. And at this point, I just want to say something. I want to say that when I spoke about taking mushrooms and going out in nature, I never do this in the United States. And the experiences that I talk about with LSD happened 40 years ago. So, yeah, exactly.
Well, that sort of sets up the you know, a zone of safety.
Well, yeah, it's the way it is. What can I say?
I mean, for me, you know, I will acknowledge that I've had these experiences even, you know, after 19, after the years when these drugs became criminalized. That I think that from the point of view of most of the police authorities,
yes,
they really, you know, that's not the what that's not their top priority, to try to block people from
right
go after people that report these experiences. So, for example, in this particular issue about psychedelics and ecology, pretty much everybody's experience that they write about was illegal.
Right, but everybody
is courageous enough, and also they put their names, they put their pictures, they put their email.
You bet.
But they're really not that much at risk.
Right, right.
But, you know, it's really a waste of resources for our police authorities to go after people who report on these sorts of experiences. They're really looking for distribution. They're looking for things like
right.
that. So I think that there's a zone of safety that's getting larger and larger the more people are willing to speak out about this, and particularly to speak about these experiences, not so much in terms of what a great party I was at, how much fun I had.
Oh, yeah.
But what I learned, and what I learned to respect, because these stories are about respecting nature, respecting the environment, respecting the risk, the perilous risk situation that we're in. And it's not just good for those of us that have these experiences, but we're trying to make a better world, even for the police that are trying to shut down these experiences.
Yes.
So I think that's part of this, again, ecological understanding. We're all in this together.
Yes, yes,
and
yes.
And that we need to try to make it better for everybody.
Absolutely.
So I think that we've got, through these special issues, you know, courageous people who contribute. And what they're pointing to is something that I think more and more people, if you look at what has happened, you know, the sort of characteristics of the 60s, we think about it as, you know, people were into health foods, people were into yoga, people
mm-hmm.
were into meditation, people, you know, a lot of people were vegetarians. You know, Earth Day, the whole Earth Day began, the whole environmental. Now, we did contact one of the people that started Earth Day, and he did say that he was not influenced by psychedelics.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah. At least personally, he was not influenced by psychedelics.
Right, right. Unlike Arnie Ness and Watson and Crick, or was it James Crick?
Yeah, Crick was supposedly, reports have come out that Crick was under the influence of low-dose LSD when he had the vision of the double helix.
That's right.
That was 1953, and there was already the talk about low-dose LSD as stimulating creativity.
Mm-hmm.
We do know that Carrie Mullis, who won the Nobel Prize for Chemistry for the polymerase chain reaction, which is now used by, you know, police authorities, everybody all over, to do DNA identification.
Right.
That he attributes a lot of his insights to his use of marijuana and psychedelics.
Right, right.
So that sort of plumbing into the mysteries of matter, people have been able to do that to a deeper degree as a result of their psychedelic experiences. And with Crick, you know, if it's true, you know, it seems like there's a good chance it's true.
Yes, there is.
You know, it may not be true, but reports by people who knew him have said it's true. But, again, it's this idea that it's not just the drug. It's like the expression about how something like chance favors the prepared mind.
Yes.
You know, that these tools are tools, and if they're in the hands of someone who knows how to use them well, then you can get a lot out of them. So for me, this idea that this openness to whatever comes up, while we might want a spiritual experience, we might want a connection with nature, if it's a psychological experience, that's what is being presented to us by our unconscious. There's a certain kind of wisdom to the unconscious. There's a wisdom to the process, and there's an order of things that is beyond our conscious mind.
Mm-hmm.
And we just go with that. And there's actually a poem that Leo Zeff was the leader of the underground psychedelic psychotherapy movement.
Uh-huh.
He's the one that really introduced, he's friends with Anna Sasha Shulgin, and
okay.
You know, he was the one that really helped develop the therapeutic use of MDMA.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a poem that he gave to everybody before he worked with them. It's by this Francois Fenelon,
mm-hmm.
the Archbishop of Cambrai, 1651 to 1715. I'll just read a tiny bit of it.
Uh-huh.
Lord, I know not what I ought to ask of thee. Thou only knowest what I need. This is actually so old that he gave it to me. Part of it is,
yeah.
You know, thou lovest me more than I know how to love myself. O Father, you know, I dare not ask either for crosses or for consolations. I simply present myself before thee. I open my heart to thee. Behold my needs, which I know not myself. Smite or heal, depress or raise me up. It goes on like that.
Yeah.
Teach me to pray thyself in me.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful poem. And I think that is the key to safety.
Key to safety.
That you're open to whatever, whether it's difficult emotions, beautiful emotions, and that when you try to suppress any kind of experience, psychologically, that's potentially dangerous.
Okay.
So it's kind of a long answer to your question about how do you create a safe
yes.
situation.
Well, Rick, I noticed that through these articles, these beautiful writings, the concept of shamanism comes up very much.
Yes.
And by now, the word shamanism has been and shaman has been used a lot. But still, I notice that. It might be that what certain people are saying that is that shamans can be intermediaries. How do you say that in English? Can be
intermediaries,
conduits to show people the relationship to the teacher plants, the medicine plants of the earth.
Well, I think that's true, and I think though that there's. And this is, again, where Tim was so great. It's sort of the democratization of spiritual experience. That there are certain shamans whose practice is that they take the drug and they do the healing on the person.
Right.
So there's a way in which the person who's being healed is not being empowered to heal themselves.
Uh-huh.
There's somebody strong who is healing you. And while that's really good to be healed, there's a way in which it's better to help somebody marshal their own healing resources.
Mm-hmm. Of course, yeah.
And so I think that there's a whole range of shamanistic approaches, and while they feel like they, you know, some feel like they are the intermediary, they're the powerful ones that do this to you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, others are more of a therapeutic model mindset where they help you. And I think maybe this is a good point to bring up this other issue. This was like a big bone of contention between myself and Terrence McKenna and others, where this idea that if something is from nature,
mm-hmm.
it's superior
uh-huh.
to something that comes from a laboratory.
Okay.
So that we have peyote from nature. That's somehow better than mescaline, which is extracted, but even that's really still natural.
Okay.
Somehow ayahuasca, which comes from plants, is somehow at a higher level in some people's minds than LSD,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
which, even though it's a very similar molecule as in morning glory seeds, the LSD molecule appears nowhere in nature.
Okay.
You know, now, on the other hand, I guess we are also, humans are also part of nature, and so things that we create, you know, can be considered natural also. But at least from my point of view, my personal point of view, that whether a drug comes from the laboratory or it comes from nature, that it's how it's used and what it does that are the key factors rather than... So I really don't believe, and I think there's a lot of people in the psychedelic movement who would agree and also others who would disagree, but I really think that there's no somehow spiritual superiority of compounds and molecules that are found in nature versus those that have been made through the minds of chemists. And I think, you know, for many people, you know, LSD is their introduction to this whole area.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the Good Friday experiment, there's a film group coming tomorrow doing a documentary on the Good Friday experiment.
Right.
Which we talked about in the first...
The first segment.
That we did. But, you know, that was using psilocybin, which comes from mushroom.
Yes.
And when I did my 25-year follow-up, many of those people who had this experience with... what you could say was a substance from nature. Some of them have had non-drug mystical experiences since then, which they felt were, which they slightly preferred actually, because they were more uniformly positive. They didn't have the strong oscillations between positive and negative. But others of them had experiences with LSD or other compounds, which they also felt were genuinely mystical. So I'll just say that there's kind of an aura of. Somehow this magical thinking about things that psychedelics that come from plants.
Okay.
And at least in my more Western scientific mind, you know, there's a spirit of the lab. There's a spirit of LSD, just as there can be a spirit of psilocybin or a spirit of mushrooms, spirit of peyote.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really the respect that we bring to it and the openness to what emerges that's really key, rather than whether the substances come from the lab or from nature.
And I think that's quite apparent in the interview with Jeremy Norby.
Yes.
Where he speaks about substances as amplifiers and not direct connections to certain things.
Yeah, also Stan Groth. We talked about LSD as a non-specific amplifier of the unconscious, with this idea of non-specific being that really it can open you up to any number of different things. It's not, MDMA, for example, is not non-specific. MDMA is more filled with sort of loving social communal experience.
Yes. Let me ask you this, Rick Doblin. When you drive in a town, there are various places that are called drug stores, and they're perfectly respectable. Now, most of the time, when we talk about one of these substances that we're talking about and call them drug, it's demeaning. It's been made into a demeaning term. Can you speak about this difference?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's more just if something is socially sanctioned, then it's acceptable. It's sanctioned. If something is suppressed, you know, then it's derogatory and negative. And so what I think that we need to recognize is that the fears of the culture about these psychedelic substances were in some part fears that those people that had these experiences were somehow somehow removing themselves from the web of culture, that they were counterculture.
Right.
And Tim contributed to that somewhat, where
yes.
This idea that you, you know, that you have these experiences, you somehow have a deeper understanding than the normal culture, normal people, and that you are sort of in need to remove yourself. Again, this idea that there may be private utopias.
Yes.
And so I think that there's this obligation on those of us who are involved with these substances to show that they are completely harmonious with going to the PTA meeting, you know, raising children and being concerned about things that all the other mothers and fathers are concerned about how these things can make us want to make a positive contribution to our society. So even though some of the people, and many of the people who've had these experiences, get motivated to work towards social change, but that doesn't mean anarchy, that it means trying to make a positive contribution. And I think the more that people, like, that's another thing about this special issue of the MAPS Bulletin.
Yes.
That these are people, the people that have written most of these articles, you know, have led lives that other people might not adopt themselves, that they've led lives that are, by and large, ones that deserve respect.
Yes.
And that they have got healthy relationships with their family members, and that they have been able to try to balance this psychedelic mystical understanding with living in a culture and trying to help the culture grow.
Right.
So that, you know, some of the, this idea where I talked about the shaman trying to do to you, that's very much like, you know, the priest saying, I'm your intermediary to spirituality, and only through me can you
reach
heaven
God.
Or hell.
Yeah, have a relationship with God.
Yeah, that those kind of power, status quo sort of power systems are challenged by people having more direct connection with spirituality. And yet, it's in the best interest of the larger culture that that people do have these experiences. And if we can show, those of us that have these experiences, that we are alert to certain dangers that other people are not paying attention to, like the dangers of overpopulation and species destruction, environmental destruction, and you know, poisons in the food, that that we're alert to these dangers and that we are trying to make a healthier world for everybody, that, that there doesn't have to be this kind of fear, so that when we say drug,
yes.
One day it will mean the drugs you get at the pharmacy, and psychedelics will also be at the pharmacy.
Okay.
And it will also mean drugs that you can get at your church or your synagogue or your place of worship, or that you can do outdoors in nature. That I think that we've got to heal this split. I mean, you put your finger right on it, that there is this sort of psychotic part of our culture. Drugs, in certain ways, if they're sanctioned by the culture, are good. If they're not, then they're, you know, these evil substances.
Then it's a bad word. It's the same word.
Yeah, and really, these drugs, in my mind, as you said, are sort of neutral. They're like they're a tool.
Yes.
And, you know, we know that, that large numbers of people die every year in car crashes. And that doesn't mean that cars are bad. But it means that there's a price to pay for moving at accelerated rates.
Yeah, right.
And there are prices to be paid for the unprepared who use psychedelics, or for people who are using them, and even with the noble motive of just having a spiritual experience with nature, if they deny the other parts of themselves that relate to their personality, let's say, and they just want to have a mystical experience, that that can be dangerous also in a different way.
Right.
So I think to heal this split in our culture, it requires us moving to the center, that we need to take these psychedelic experiences and package them, construct contexts where people in mainstream culture might say, yes, in my time of need, I will be open to that. And so, for example, in our work at Harvard with MDMA for cancer patients with anxiety, or our LSD study in Switzerland with End of Life, or
right.
studies that are taking place at NYU and Johns Hopkins at UCLA with psilocybin for people at End of Life, that these experiences of connection are particularly valuable to people as they're facing death.
Right.
And if they can feel like they're part of this web of life, if they feel a sense of belonging, and they feel this somehow this transcendence of time and space in a certain way, you know, our ego will not survive, our body will not survive, but you know, to some part of us is, you know, unchangeable and indestructible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, then it's easier. So we're finding in different ways the love of nature, the peace that comes from accepting of mortality, that these are ways to bring these substances into the mainstream.
Okay.
And hopefully one day there will be these sanctioned contexts.
Right.
You know, I mean, for many people, you know, the recreational, even the raves that are held outdoors, the dances that are held outdoors, when people have danced all night and they start to see the sunrise, that is such a beautiful sight.
There's awe.
It's awe, and it's connection to nature. It's so healing and healthy. And it puts people in a different context, and it empowers them. So I think that actually, in part because there's all these baby boomers that are now entering the final stages of their lives,
mm-hmm.
and have an early experience and comfort level with psychedelics,
mm-hmm.
that time is now on our side as far as this integration process. So that this idea that certain drugs are demonized and disrespected, I think that we will see over the next 20 years further integration of these drugs into our culture and further use of them by many, many people to deepen their connection with nature.
Yes.
And this, if the next 10 years we have another issue on psychedelics and ecology, I would imagine we'll have a whole new group of potential authors.
Okay, I'm a volunteer.
That would be wonderful.
Oh, thank you.
I think it's what is needed.
Rick, thank you so much for what you've been saying. And we're going to bring our conversation around now. And I just want a lot of people to hear what you're saying. And I want to thank you for your fantastic work.
Oh, well, thank you, Jenna. And if people want to become members of MAPS, I mean, we're a nonprofit and we require donations to support our research projects. And there's information on maps.org, our website. If people want to join, we'd be very appreciative and grateful for whatever support people can offer. And that it's still to the point where we're not getting government grants, we're not getting grants from major foundations, we're not getting grants from the pharmaceutical industry, that it's really individuals who care about this whole area, not all of whom have had experiences, some of whom just care for other reasons, but whatever support people want to offer, that would be most appreciated.
Wonderful. Okay. Thank you, Rick Doblin.
Thank you, Jenna. Thank you.